Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Tom Edwards.
On today's show, just in time for Halloween, we'll be celebrating the spookiest tale of them all, Frankenstein. Curator for UCL Museums, Subhadra Das, will be telling us why the fear of a man-made monster shows no signs of going away.
We'll also be hearing from Oscar-winning filmmaker Morgan Neville. The acclaimed documentary director will be talking us through his latest, They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, an ode to the turbulent career of Orson Welles.
And we'll be taking a tour around the world in 80 words with writer and curiosity specialist Paul Anthony Jones. He'll be discussing his new book at the end of the show.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be embarking on a quick tour of next week's news as well. And we'll enjoy some music right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Rob.
The last time we presented this show together, talks about great holiday in Japan, climbing up the active volcano. The injury sustained on that ascent, or rather the descent, has
always,
come back to haunt
it's
me.
It's always worse. It's like tackling a flight of stairs with a sporting injury. You think, oh, I made it up. That was fine.
Yeah.
You just wait till you head on down again.
Before this descends into farce, should we talk about next week's news with who on earth we got this week?
It's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. There was something.
Welcome to the programme.
In times of darkness, we need that.
Yeah.
Sorry for being so negative already.
That's all right. I think I probably know what you're referring to.
Yes.
The old home country coming back to bite you.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it's going to bite quite hard,
actually. Big day today, isn't it?
It's big day. And after the show, I'm going there to the Brazilian embassy to vote, to make my point. And I have to say, it's one of the biggest communities in Europe for Brazilians. Last time, I think there were some people there for 3 hours in the queue, actually.
Wow.
So if you see a group of like green and yellow supporters, that's where the embassy is.
I'll come and mix you up some caipirinhas for the queue.
Exactly.
That's exactly what you guys want.
And I wonder, Faye, is it, because we've touched upon this before in the station, is it exactly what you'd expect in terms of that expat demographic? Are they voting in a more worldly wise, internationalist kind of way? I gather not necessarily.
Not necessarily, actually. In fact, for example, if I take just London as an example, it voted very similar to what Brazilians voted. In fact, the Bolsonaro support in London was a bit higher than the average Brazilian population. But the candidate, Fernando Haddad, he can say that, okay, I think he might lose this election, but he won in Paris, in Stockholm and Berlin. I mean, that's cool, right?
That's a very interesting statistic.
Yeah.
There's a very interesting sort of world map to be drawn of kind of the voting habits of expat populations all around the world and what sort of city they might vibe off if they're this particular persuasion, that kind of voting pack,
well, it's telling, and it would be telling if London also returns Bolsonaro. That would, I think, I'd like to think that would surprise many people, but perhaps it shouldn't, and that's a sad state of affairs.
No, and it's interesting. I mean, we've been covering the Brazilian election, you know, the whole week here at Monocle 24, but it's going to be interesting. I think the same thing for the Brits and Brexit, Americans and Trump. How to be a Brazilian in a Bolsonaro era, because I never had to confront that, and in a way, I do use my Brazilianness a little bit as soft power, but it's going to be harder. It's going to change a lot of things, because then people say, wow, you have, a man that clearly says some extremely inappropriate things, and he's pro-torture. So it will change a little bit the image of the country, and I think a lot of Brazilians are not noticing that. Keeping again in the topic of elections, also another topic that we've been discussing is the rise of the Greens in Germany, and they're voting today as well in Hesse, and I think they might become the first party there. So it's kind of good news, because finally populism is not winning in Germany. I know the AfD, you know, their support has been increasing, but perhaps not as much as many people expected. So maybe there is a way,
Well, and possibly it's reassuring that abandoning the traditional mainstream or the big two, we've seen that in this country, and we certainly saw it in France, for example, it doesn't mean you have to go to the extreme left or right. Maybe there's a completely new voice, a new perspective. And the Greens have been doing very well, certainly in the European Parliament for a long time, and not bad in Germany.
Yeah,
and to win out, or to be the biggest party, someone like Hesse would still be a real statement.
Absolutely. And I mean, the Greens, they have been very established in Germany. In fact, they were kind of empowering Hesse in 1985. It was one of the first times that the Greens, you know, I think they governed together with the Social Democrats. So, but now this time they will be the major party because the Social Democrats are not doing very well as well. But yeah, two elections that I'm very curious to see the results, and let's see what's going to happen in Brazil. It, to be honest, it feels to me almost like Halloween in a very strange way. But
so it's the right week, but potentially the wrong political outcome.
Exactly. Well, that's my third story, guys. Halloween.
Yes.
31st of October.
What will you be doing, Fernando?
Well, I have to say, I don't like celebrate Halloween. I don't go into parties, but I'm a huge horror fan. So I think it could be an excuse to watch a film.
Big old screening night around the Pacheco household.
Absolutely. Yeah. I do love it. And of course, the scariest one of them all for me is Freddy Krueger.
Really? I'm on Elm Street.
I still have nightmares of him. So it's terrible.
You're a child of the 80s. But there's another Halloween movie out, isn't there?
Yeah.
Have you seen that, Fernando?
I haven't.
Would you be tuning into that, maybe?
Absolutely. I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis is back. And so it's interesting about Halloween that it's all about Jamie Lee Curtis and not only about the killer, Michael Myers, in fact. So I think, and in the film, she plays like a grandma that she has kind of depression. So they did change a little bit the story to reflect the world we live in. And I think this will happen. Apparently, there'll be a new Friday the 13th as well, another remake.
Man, it's just what we need.
It's just what we need.
What's your sort of Halloween viewing, Tom, of choice? What's your favourite spooky movie?
I was very much a sort of shut the curtains, turn the lights out and hide upstairs and pretend not to be there.
Yeah.
So as to avoid the whole thing. But now, obviously, with the young children, and my older one is aware of Halloween, so I'm going to have to go out on the trick-or-treating trail.
You are, yeah.
With a child dressed as... Well, it could be a sort of friendly dinosaur or maybe one of the Paw Patrollers.
Thanks for bringing Halloween into this. I feel that there are going to be ripples of Halloween through this programme. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much.
This weekend, early revelers have hit the streets to celebrate Halloween. The annual Fright Fest itself actually falls this coming Wednesday, officially, but that's no reason not to get into the spooky spirit early.
Hand in ghoulish hand with Halloween comes Frankenstein, the novel by Mary Shelley, published 200 years ago this year. The tale of a man-made monster created by scientist Victor Frankenstein has captured imaginations ever since. And the life of its author, Mary Shelley, who single-handedly invented modern horror at the age of 19, was possibly as equally dramatic as the book itself.
Subhadra Das is curator at UCL Culture and Collections here in London, and this coming Wednesday she and cultural historian John J. Johnston will be celebrating all things Frankenstein at the Petrie Museum, and she's here to give us a sneak preview ahead of that event. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Subhadra. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
An enduring fascination with, I guess, the macabre story, but it's a story that's about as well, I suppose, the limits of science. So maybe that's one of the reasons why this traditional story, I don't know, seems to be ever more relevant to the times in which we live.
Absolutely, yeah. So I'm a curator of science collections and my area of research is the history and philosophy of science. And that's why I'm really interested in this story. Because not only did Mary Shelley single-handedly invent horror as a genre, she invented science fiction as a genre. And that's what we're going to be talking about, looking at these ideas of what is the position of science in society. And I think that's kind of the answer to your question, is why this idea has lasted for so long is we still do science, we still have society. We haven't quite figured out how to do either of those two things properly. And Frankenstein lives in that liminal, scary gap between the two.
And is something I wonder personally fascinating about the story to you, all the people that you're expecting to attend your event, and kind of the folklore surrounding it, is how possible it is. You know, that idea that we kind of feel, I guess, 200 years ago, there was a fear of its possibility. We nudge nearer to that possibility nowadays. Does it maybe get more relevant? Do our fears maybe get more kind of potent?
The science is certainly improving. So if anything, we're closer to being able to achieve rejuvenating corpses now with the science that we have, because obviously we're 200 years on with the science as well. But important to point out that we might be closer to understanding how to go about doing it. In terms of the mechanics, we're still not quite there yet. But the idea... So I work with pathology collections at UCL, so 8,000 bits of dead people. When I work with that kind of material, or when I work with the auto icon of Jeremy Bentham, our very famous philosopher preserved dead man in box, the things that we come across is, what do we think about death? And death is the one thing that we all have in common. We're all going to die one day in an ideal situation. So if that is the thing that we all have in common, if it's the one thing that's inescapable about our lives, obviously it's going to be a continual point of fascination for, is there a way that we can bypass that maybe? Because the thing about being alive, I guess, is an occupational hazard of it, is that you want to continue to be alive, whether it's good for you or not. And what I'm interested in is possibly thinking a bit more problematically about those things.
Wow, this is going to be an amazing event, isn't it?
It's absolutely fascinating. One thing I find interesting is the way that it's been sort of culturally appropriated, even without science, even without literature. You know, people use Frankenstein often incorrectly, but they use the adjectively. We have Frankenstein foods when talk about genetic modification. Mm-hmm. I wonder, could Mary Shelley have envisaged that it would be something that would speak to all these other areas of life, as well as devising horror and science fiction? It's become something that's employed by the sort of commentariat more broadly as well, hasn't it?
Definitely. I don't know whether she would have, because predicting, looking into the future, as brilliant as Mary Shelley was, I don't know about her foresight and how far into the future she was able to see. But what she was able to understand was that we're always going to have this tension between what it is that we're capable of doing as humans. I mean, the subtitle of the novel is The Modern Prometheus. So how, as humans, can we take power away from God? I'm doing the quote marks. You can't see on the radio, but I'm doing the quote marks around God. How do we take the power away from that, and what can we do with it? And, yeah, it's really interesting when you talk about it becomes an adjective. If you track the use of Frankenstein food is probably one we're talking about the late 80s coming into the 90s. Nowadays, we're worried about things like AI, genetic editing. But if you go back to, say, the 1920s, Frankenstein was applied to subjects like chemistry. Going into the 30s, it was things like medicine, because those were the sciences that were developing. We were at the cutting edge of those and starting to really alter the natural order of things. I guess that's the history of science of the 20th century is, it's become so advanced that we're bypassing the natural order of things. And that's what really she's tapping into. But I wonder whether she's doing that in 1800, which is 200 years ago. But those ideas are kind of there in the beginnings of the Enlightenment anyway, this idea of science, its role in society and our capability. And where is God in this scenario? Where are we as humans in this scenario?
I often think that kind of Frankenstein is misplaced as a novel. It's got great gothic leanings, but it's a novel, as you say, it's a science fiction novel. It's very much a novel about the future and about the ideas of godliness and the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. You said that your job involves working with 800 bits of dead people.
1,000.
8,000.
8,000 specimens.
Man alive, I'm a good journalist. I even get a missing a zero off that one, Bobby.
Man very much not alive.
Do you have a sense, and at this time of year you're called on to be macabre about it and have a sort of sense of humour, a strange sense of humour about it, but do you see it as that? You're surrounded by death, but in as a way of understanding life, as a way of understanding attitudes to both of those things. The other 364 days of the year, do you kind of have to poo-poo those ideas of the macabre, I wonder?
No, I'm not in the business of telling other people what to think. If people want to be macabre, if they want to be morbid, that is very much their way of being in the world, and it's not up to me to say that. My job is to take care of the stuff and to tell stories using the stuff to be able to speak to
those experiences.
But is
it wearing sometimes to have to kind of make a jolly out of something that's a potent scientific reason?
I see what you're saying. I think humour is kind of my way around most situations. So the other, when I'm not doing death, I'm doing racism. Okay. Both of them hilarious. Yeah, so humour is kind of the way that I bypass these things anyway. And I think it's probably the case with a lot of the death crowd, the people that work with the dead. I mean, museums is a teeny part of the death crowd in terms of professionals who work with dead bodies. That kind of gallows humour is inevitably a part of your way of coping, because when you're confronted with corpses, I don't know what your personal experience is with corpses. This isn't a question I'm not interested to know particularly, but it's not a normal thing. Dead bodies and death and the idea of not being alive anymore are still kind of taboo subjects in our world. And it's not the kind of thing that we're necessarily comfortable talking about. The humour is one way round that. So I don't mind it necessarily. I'm not your full-on goth. I am dark in other ways. But, that's not necessarily my way of looking at it, but it works for a lot of people, and God bless them. They look, I mean, again, God in question marks.
they look fabulous. He comes into a lot of this discussion.
I know, it's almost, it's he. Yeah, it's exactly. Very difficult to get away from, yeah. Absolutely.
Well, to that point, I was going to ask you actually about the fact that, you know, people talk now, social media, oh, nothing's off limits. And if you look at politicians, they'll go anywhere. And the sort of rhetoric you hear, there is no taboo anymore. But it does seem that death retains something, even beyond all sorts of other terrible things, which somehow people seem to be more comfortable allowing into the sort of popular discourse. Death still retains that. Is it because it's so fundamental, or maybe the fear is so fundamental? Why does that not happen, given we can kind of broach it on days like Halloween or with stories like Frankenstein?
Well, that's the point of Halloween as a festival in and of itself, is that this is the one day of the year where the ghouls and the ghasties, and they're allowed to walk the earth with the rest of us, and we dress up in order to make sure that they don't accidentally take us back to the netherworld with them. And yeah, I think I'd probably question the first thing you said there. I find it laughable that politicians talk about everything that's important to be talked about. I don't think they do at all. And I think things like sex, things like death, still very much taboo. Put the two things together, you almost never get to talk about those. Not my area of expertise, I need to point out to you. But yeah, there are plenty of things. As I said, I talk about race and racism within society a lot. That's a difficult subject because I think Halloween particularly, and also, is it me or is it like, without, I'm not even going to mention the C word at this point in time, but it's getting earlier every year and the windows are full of all kinds of decorations and stuff and all power to people. We live in difficult times. I'm not going to take people's joy away. But it is a very sanitized and a very kind of, this is what Frankenstein's monster looks like. It's got green skin and bolts in its neck and a tabletop head, which is nothing like what the creature looks like in the book. I think that the tabooness of it is still pretty much there. It's just we've found ways of sanitizing it. So, yeah, Halloween is one day of the year, but our approach to a sanitized way of talking about difficult things, that's every day of the year.
Yeah, the sanitized version of Frankenstein the monster is an interesting thing. That you see there are kind of cute, cuddly toys of the Boris Karloff idea of
people have never seen the film.
Yeah, but do you know what I mean? It's like, and then it's like that is the standard thing with the kind of arms that stick out, and you know, but he's kind of lovely, you know, kind of
the Herman Munster approach.
Yeah, exactly. The cuddly Frankenstein's monster is a strange thing. Does that make a night like Wednesday night? Does that make it more or less easy? Are you trying to sort of at least rock some of those icons? Yeah. Or not? Or are you playing into the kind of familiar themes or familiar look of these things?
Well, it's, and we're the setting is an important part of that as well, because
The Petrie Museum. Petrie Museum.
Yeah, in theory, the theme, we probably should be talking about mummies, but we're not going to be. Sorry to disappoint anyone there. But the anniversary was an important thing to kind of deal with these ideas. And also it's to do with John and me and our expertise and the kind of things we talk about. It's not going to be cuddly, I don't think. I don't know whether you're getting this from me entirely. Cuddly is possibly not entirely where I live. It's going to be friendly. It's going to be warm. We're going to invite people to contribute to the discussion. But yeah, it's not going to be, don't come expecting necessarily a comfortable experience. I quite enjoy making people feel uncomfortable by questioning the basis of assumptions that we live in with society. But there'll also be cool films to watch, and John is amazing. What he doesn't know about horror films is not worth knowing. So there's going to be a lot of an education here as well.
I mean, I this time of year, this and Bonfire Night, obviously neither of these things have a kind of pagan ritual thing, especially Bonfire Night, which is obviously a very kind of
religio-political
thing. Yeah. But, like, I mean, there is something kind of dark and feels like something about the essence of ourselves is being brought out by these things that we choose to celebrate, even if there's something about which we don't believe or whatever. Mm. There is something about that. Do you have that in you, or do you notice that sort of the frailty of our human framework, our kind of sense of, you might call it the Enlightenment, our sense of science, is easily shaken by the tap on the window pane on a dark night and sort of analogous things like that?
Yeah, I'm not a neuroscientist, but there is something about that reptile brain and the, you know, the shadows creeping across. And these are, there is an aspect of evolutionary mechanism, which is that, you know, if you didn't look up in time, if you weren't scared by things, then the eagle was going to get you, or the lion, or whatever it was. So being afraid is definitely an evolutionary adaptation. What's interesting, I think, to do with modern society is the ways in which it applies to us, but then we have to kind of find ways around it too. We in the Western world live in a hugely anxious society, and I think a lot of that is to do with the monkeyness of our brain trying to adjust to the civilized world. And again, no quote marks, but close on civilized, because you know, this is these are the ways around it. But yeah, I think And I should also point out, psychologically, one of the reasons I really want to reframe Frankenstein as science fiction rather than horror is I really don't like horror films. I don't like being scared. It's not where my joy is. So that's part of the, yeah, we all kind of shape these things to be a bit more comfortable. It's just for once you've got someone like me in charge of the situation, being able to shape it the way that I want to shape it.
And if people aren't interested in the sort of fright night of it, there's an enduring fascination with, I suppose, that sense of exploring the darkness that could be within all of us. And it's the same as the sort of Jekyll and Hyde and many of these things. Mm. And it's funny, you were reflecting earlier on the sort of increasingly sanitized nature of much discourse, whether it be about death or just about anything, frankly. Yeah. These, whether it's a 200-year-old novel, they offer an endlessly fascinating pathway to reflect on that. Is that why people have an enduring fascination, whether it's in crime writing and it's about murder or things that are really actually kind of horrendous to read? It's like the news agenda is the same, but is it because people can't help but think, what if it happened to me? Could I do it? I mean, is that understandable as you see it, that people think that way?
Definitely. And familiarity is an aspect of this as well. So we do have these iconic horror figures that we're always coming back to. Frankenstein and the Creature is one of those. Jekyll and Hyde is definitely another one, because it's always, they are these individual people, and the horror is kind of the method of telling the story. If you think about it, this might be for next year, we can reframe the Mummy's a love story. It's not a horror story. It's about a guy who wants his girlfriend back, and will go to extreme lengths to be able to do that, including defying death itself. So the enduringness of it, without wanting to take away from people's interest in it, some of it is to do with the shorthand. There are stories that we are just commonly exposed to. There are plenty of other kind of ghost and ghoul stories in other cultures that we're not necessarily that familiar with, that don't replicate themselves. I have to see if I can find a way to bring those in somehow. But yeah, that's why novels are great, right? Mm. It's why museums are great, because museums are full of cool stuff and you can come in and you can think about these things and think about those ideas.
God, it's fascinating stuff, isn't it? He's come into it again. In inquisitive commas. Subhadra Das, thank you very much indeed. You can hear more from Subhadra and John J. Johnson at the Peachey Museum in London this Wednesday, the 31st of October. Halloween, the day itself. And that's from 6:30 p.m. There's a glass of wine in the £5 price ticket too. Head down. Right now, you're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
Time for some music, Rob?
Oh, why not? Halloween music?
We've got something actually scarier, Rob, even than that, but catchy as hell. This is Rocky Erickson from 1981 with I Think of Demons.
Rocky Erickson there with I Think of Demons. You are listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. We'll be hearing from the filmmaker Morgan Neville right after this.
Filmmaker Morgan Neville has turned his documentary lens to figures both caught in the spotlight and hidden away from it. He won an Oscar and a Grammy in 2014 for his film 20 Feet from Stardom, which looked at the careers of backing singers, while 2016's Best of Enemies covered the fevered political and ethical debates between Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley.
His latest film is They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, looking at the life of one-of-a-kind filmmaker Orson Welles and the making of his final film, The Other Side of the Wind. The latter film languished in production hell for decades, since shooting wrapped in the mid-1970s. But now a finished version will shortly be hitting screens, along with Morgan Neville's documentary via Netflix.
Monocle's Tom Hall met Morgan Neville recently to discuss it all. But first, here's a clip of They'll Love Me When I'm Dead.
The Other Side of the Wind is the crazy picture. It's not a work of fiction. And it's a little of everything. It's kind of a departure in movie making.
Orson Welles was the ultimate independent filmmaker.
Somewhere between Zen master and God.
No other director has been held up to such an impossible standard.
Citizen Kane, the greatest motion picture ever made.
Do you agree?
No, certainly not. That's my next one is, though.
Could you give us the title of that?
I haven't decided what it is yet.
Oh.
The
The Other Side of the Wind, what is that? Orson Welles' last movie.
Everything else I've ever done has been controlled, but I want to go further.
It's a story of the last day of the director's life.
The darling of Hollywood who fell out of favor.
Wait a minute, that's Orson. Is it? Orson, is that you?
Everybody will think it's autobiographical, but it's not.
Yeah, bullshit.
So The Other Side of the Wind was Orson Welles' last completed scripted film, though never edited, but he shot the whole thing. And so the film is about a film director at the end of his life who comes back to America after years of living abroad to make an art film, and he can't finish the film because of lack of funds. And that film Orson was making was a film within a film. And then I was lucky enough to get all of Orson's raw footage, 100 hours of dailies, and make a film about that. So it's a film within a film within a film about a filmmaker who can't finish a film, which makes it a very Wellesian kind of film.
He felt shunned by Hollywood. He was shunned by certain organizations. And towards the end of his career, he was having to work in quite unusual ways just to get films made. I mean, there's that great sort of tale where he shot a punch in the face for Othello, mm-hmm. and then had to shoot the reaction of like the guy basically just punching back 2 years later in a location 1,000 miles away. What were the conditions that defined Welles's career that, you know, made him work in the ways that he did?
I mean, somebody says in the documentary that Welles started as a professional and became an amateur. And I think they mean that as a compliment. You know, Welles started his career as the wunderkind, you know, working at RKO Studios with Citizen Kane and having the machinery of big studios and great DPs and crews. And as his career went on, and frankly, as he continued to make films that lost money, he ended up going to Europe and learning a different technique of filmmaking, which was much more about editing and a much, much scrappier kind of filmmaking, which he grew to love. But it was something that was not polished in that way. And so at the end of his life, which is what my film covers, the last 15 years of Orson's life, he was doing two things. He was acting often in not the greatest of movies. He was on talk shows. He was doing bad wine commercials in America, but commercials everywhere. And I think he was seen kind of culturally as a punchline, as like a has-been. And the reality was he did all those things so he could be making his own movies. His quote was, as an actor, I'm a prostitute, but as a director, I remain virginal. So to him, he would take these acting jobs because he thought of acting as kind of a base art form. It came so naturally to him. He didn't think of it as anything special. He thought that filmmaking was the pinnacle of artistic achievement. So he was making these films, mainly The Other Side of the Wind, but a number of other films throughout this period. And none of them ever saw the light of day. So the public never got to see what Orson was doing with the money he was making and all those efforts. So in a way, this film's trying to show that Orson actually was more vibrant and scrappier, the most kind of independent filmmaker you could imagine late in his career.
Do you think he was dismissive purely of his own acting, as in, you know, it's not my primary concern and I'll do it if I have to? Or do you think he was dismissive of all actors? Because that's a funny thing for a director to be saying for the people who, A, even if you don't personally think that their performance is something that moves you, it's got to move your audience. So to be that dismissive of the art form of acting is a very strange thing for a director to say, isn't it?
It is. And I think he was more dismissive of his own acting, though he could be critical of other actors. However, the actors that worked with Orson, he adored. Orson was the consummate actor's director. And those people, he had many people that worked with him on many films over many years, they adored him and he adored them. So he would treat them with kid gloves and just, you know, give them everything they needed. Then he would turn to the crew, and he was the most difficult taskmaster when it came to the crew. So it was very night and day how he treated the two. But he loved actors in that way. He just didn't think of his own acting ability as anything special. He thought of it as something that was easily, you know, monetizable.
And, I mean, he's this auteur who was ahead of his time and, as you say, kind of worked in any way he wanted just to get it done, and also any way that it was possible to get it done if the conditions were sort of adverse. When I look at that sort of way of working, it seems to me quite a contemporary thing as well. It's like you have all these today, like YouTube stars or whatever, and kind of just Instagram celebrities and stuff working on their own terms. I don't mean to equate, you know, the greatness of Orson Welles with that sort of faddish, trendy kind of outlook. But do you think that perhaps if he started his career today, he would have had a lot more avenues to get things done?
Without a doubt. I mean, so many people that knew Orson said some version of, if Orson was around today with the technology we have, he would have loved it. I mean, the fact that you could shoot a movie on a phone and edit it on a laptop would have been Orson's dream. Because I think the machinery and the mechanics and the expense of making movies was, those were the handcuffs that Orson had his whole career. It was so difficult to be able to make a feature film at that time. And now I think he would have loved it. I mean, I think he'd be making movies every day and posting them. And, you know, he was not precious about things like cinema and just the idea of being able to tell stories and iterate and experiment was exactly what he wanted. He just couldn't do it in the old, you know, modes of filmmaking that he was coming up in.
I mean, it's absolutely obvious from the film itself and just talking to you. I mean, I'm going to take an assumption here. You are a fan. I wonder, though, watching your own films, the impression I get you're a quite meticulous filmmaker and you really enjoy reveling in the details. I mean, the fact that you made a film about backing singers rather than the singers, the main stage stars, sort of says to me that you're kind of interested in everything that's going on in the picture and trying to find the devil in the detail almost. Does Orson Welles' sensibility sort of speak to your filmmaking, or is it more like you just appreciate it from afar?
I think I'm a very different type of filmmaker from Orson, because Orson says in the documentary, and he said it many times, that to him the director's job was to preside over accidents. And what that meant for Orson was that if things were going smoothly, the director's job was to create accidents and then preside over them. So Orson was the first person to throw a hand grenade into a situation if it was moving too smoothly. So I think something about that chaos created frictions that created unexpected consequences, and he loved that. Yeah, I don't work that way. I've been making documentaries for a long time, but I come out of journalism, and I love observing and writing and understand deadlines in a way that Orson never understood deadlines. So I think I'm very different in that way. But there's something so romantic about how Orson approached his art, because it was so pure. I mean, for better or worse, you know, in terms of his career, but just in terms of his approach to films, he was so pure about things that he wouldn't compromise one inch on anything he wanted to do. And consequently, a lot of projects he made, not just Other Side of the Wind, but at least a handful of other films he was making for years, never got finished because he couldn't finish them exactly as he wanted. Even though people had offered him money and other opportunities, they always came with strings, and he wasn't willing to have strings attached.
You're an Oscar winner, which is an incredible achievement in itself. But I mean, your films have repeatedly been successful and repeatedly been loved, whereas Orson Welles did not achieve that. It's a widely held view that Citizen Kane, for example, is the greatest film ever made. Many people say this, but I always enjoy just asking, well, what if it isn't, you know? Is there any sort of precedence to maybe saying that early on in his career, it was a bit of a fluke and he did not deliver time and time again as a great filmmaker would?
Well, Citizen Kane, some film has to be the greatest film of all time just because people like to put together lists. So Kane became this kind of go-to film. And it is an amazing film. And there were many things that happened just because it was the right time at the right place with the right script. However, it wasn't an accident. I mean, there was so much intelligence and thought and things that Orson was willing to do that other filmmakers hadn't, because Orson came out of theater, not out of film. You know, Kane is a great film, but it was the only time in his career he actually was able to make a film at a studio with full control. And he was never able to ever again. So, you know, films like his next film, Magnificent Ambersons, that was kind of butchered by the studio famously, and then every film after that came with compromise. So I wonder what would have happened if Orson had been able to had that those kinds of resources and had that much control as he did on that first film. I don't know. And I don't think Orson was looking to go back either. I think Orson was looking to go ahead. And certainly by the time you get to The Other Side of the Wind, he's doing something that's so avant-garde in a way. It's miles away from Citizen Kane. But it's also kind of a bookend to what Kane was about. It's an interesting 70s avant-garde take on what happens to great American figures like Welles himself.
In your view, what is the greatest film of all time?
Oh, God, I don't know. I've got some go-to films. I mean, I'll say two films. One, because I started as a journalist. All the President's Men is a film I just can't stop watching. So that's maybe personally one of my all-time favorite films. But also of Welles' films, my favorite film is F for Fake, which was this documentary he made in the middle of making The Other Side of the Wind. In the early 70s, he makes this kind of avant-garde essay documentary, which is about an art forger and about the biographer of this art forger who himself is a forger, and about Welles, the filmmaker, who himself is a forger because of War of the Worlds and other hoaxes. So it's a film about a hoaxer by a hoaxer by a hoaxer, which is so Orson Welles. So that film was one of the films that got me into wanting to be a documentary filmmaker and was really kind of my North Star in thinking about making this film, you know, because I felt like Orson had more ideas in that film that have never been followed up on than virtually any documentary I've seen.
I have been watching a lot of documentaries recently, and I think something really interesting is happening. Like, it's where documentary is meeting really creative storytelling, right? Mm-hmm. But I think there's a sort of thing going on sometimes where that journalistic angle where you present the facts as they are is sort of slipping a little bit because people are withholding really obvious details sometimes. And you watch like a few episodes of something or a whole thing and you'll be like, well, I wonder what the answer could be because it's surely not the obvious thing. And then you get to the end and it's like, oh, it was the obvious thing that any journalist or any sort of real good documentarian should ask. Do you have a sort of view of what's going on there? I mean, where's the line between creative storytelling and a really solid factual documentary?
You know, it is changing. But I think the old ideas of documentary that I was taught when I was in college of cinema verite, which is an oxymoron to me, this idea that truth is to be found. I think for younger filmmakers, being the arbiters of a singular truth is something that isn't even something to aspire to in a way. And it's not that I think filmmakers care about the truth. I think it's more that we acknowledge the subjectivity of every situation. I mean, I've thought a lot about it with this Welles film because Welles was so full of contradictions, and I met people who directly contradicted each other again and again on Welles. And I came to think of Welles as somebody for whom the truth was kaleidoscopic, you know, that in any situation there was a different truth because Welles was a different person in every room. He was an actor by nature, and he was, you know, shape-shifting in that way as the truth is. So not to say that we give up on the truth, but I feel like it's more about empowering the audience to make up their own mind about what they think the truth is. That's how I think about it now. But is there manipulation going on? Sure, but that's cinema.
And finally, what's next? Can you tease us with anything that you're kind of looking forward to in the future?
I mean, I have this other film coming out here in the UK about Fred Rogers called Won't You Be My Neighbor? Nobody in the UK knows who Fred Rogers is. In America, he's as famous as anybody. They're making a movie with Tom Hanks playing Fred Rogers right now. And he was a hugely influential children's TV host and kind of a surprising moral leader at the time. And I made a film about him and I'm trying to explain him to people in England because he is a fascinating character. And I hope people get to see that too.
Morgan Neville there speaking to Tom Hall and They Will Love Me When I'm Dead and the finished version of Orson Welles' final film, The Other Side of the Wind, are released on Netflix on the 2nd of November.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
Paul Paul Anthony Jones is a writer fascinated with words themselves, where they come from, how they change, and how we find meaning in them, despite some making absolutely no sense at all.
His latest book is Around the World in 80 Words, and it looks at how geographical locations have given names to some of our most everyday items, from limericks to Panama hats. Earlier, Tom Edwards caught up with Paul to learn more.
Paul Anthony Jones, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Great to have you with us, and thanks for chatting to us about Around the World in 80 Words. The little sort of subtitle is A Journey Through the English Language. And I wonder, how do you start and stop a story like this? Because it is a bit like picking up a dictionary or browsing a map. You can just be lost forever. Do you ever get just sort of lost on these little meanders that you go on?
Yes, absolutely. It's kind of how I came up with the idea of running the book together as a route around the world. I kind of initially thought I would just pull it together as a dictionary and it would be almost a sort of A to Z list of these kinds of words. But then it kind of started to fall into place that one followed the other and that maybe we could join these up and they would become a kind of travelable route all around the world. So yeah, I got totally lost putting this together. It took longer to put the 80 destinations together than it did to actually write the book, I think.
What strikes me as funny, I think, is it even on the first page of the introduction? There's sort of footnotes which are almost longer than the body copy, which is shows these sort of cul-de-sacs you go down. To that point, though, did you constantly find that there weren't kind of elegant answers and therein lied the charm? You know, the fact that there are so many of these stories, there's differences of opinion, and in many cases, there isn't really a right or wrong. I don't know, is that part of the allure, the fact that you never probably know the right answer, if you like?
Yeah, it's one of the charming things about etymology, and also one of the very frustrating things about etymology, is that you can start researching something and it might come to nothing. You might actually, after days and days and days or weeks and weeks of researching something, have to hold your hands up and go, no, you know what? We don't know. We don't know where this word comes from. We don't know why people say this. You might have 24 theories, but the idea that you can pinpoint one of them more than the other will just perpetually kind of elude you, I guess, by the end of all of your research, which you kind of have to buy into. You can either get frustrated by it or you can kind of just think that it's part of the charm of it. And I like to think that it's part of the charm of it.
And to that point, I wonder, are there certain place names, and we'll talk about more specific examples in the book in a second, that just have a sort of weird, almost X factor about them? I mean, one such, I know you've got one of the little chapters on Timbuktu. There's just something about that. It's poetic. It's, I don't know, is it the sound of the word, the timbre? Some places just have a draw to them that kind of seems to go beyond anything, even a convenient linguistic explanation.
Yeah, I mean, there is no kind of reason really why that word should be as famous as it is, apart from the fact that it sounds really brilliant. It's just a nice sounding word. It's rhythmical. It has this sort of nice bouncy sort of rhythm to it. And to English speakers especially, it sounds very exotic. It sounds just about as different from an English word as you can get. You know, it ends in a U. I mean, English words kind of don't often come into that kind of category. So yeah, it kind of ticks all of the boxes, I guess. And that's one of the reasons why it's just become such a well-known name for such a far-flung destination. A lot of people don't even realise that it's a genuine place, and it is. It's one of these sort of crossroads trading towns in Mali in the middle of the Sahara Desert. So I think a lot of people think that it's some sort of fictitious kind of Xanadu kind of place, but it isn't. It's a real town.
Well, you do write about Xanadu later in the book without a spoiler alert. What about the places, though, that are definitively connected with a different meaning? I'm thinking of things like cayenne pepper or, you know, manila envelopes. Do you find it frustrating as someone who's fascinated with these things that there's so many people out there that don't say, oh, hang on, is that manila as in manila the place? Do you find it sort of almost irritating that people are not as inquisitive as you evidently are?
It's not so much irritating as it is sort of surprising that it's like people will have turkey for Christmas dinner and they'll never join the dots that turkey is named after turkey. They're sort of two separate entities in their brain. It's like that you've got the word on this side that applies to the bird and you've got the place name on this side that's the country. And it's kind of, it takes almost a book like this or a conversation like this to join those up and go, oh, actually, yeah, they are connected. There is a reason why kind of A connects to B. So yeah, to me, it's the best subject in the world. It is what keeps my brain going, definitely. But it's surprising to see that other people aren't quite as kind of connected in that sense.
Paul, how different is that picture around the world? Because I know people may be familiar with a whole range of books you've written on language, but also on trivia. And I often think this is a peculiarly British area of expertise. I don't know why, whether it's some sort of strange post-colonial legacy or something. Am I mistaken to think that? And in fact, do you find pockets of fascination with the trivia, with the devil in the detail, wherever in the world you go?
I think so, yeah. I think as kind of different cultures have broadened and have kind of connected, especially in the last few decades with everything being online, is that people have become more and more interested in smaller and smaller things. You kind of end up finding out that you've got something in common with someone who you would never normally meet on the other side of the world. And so as the kind of world gets smaller, what we get interested in becomes smaller, and the sort of minutiae of things becomes really important. So I don't think it's a sort of, it is very quintessentially British, but I don't think it's a purely British thing. I think it's something that's kind of across all cultures.
Well, and just quickly on that, you mentioned the internet there. Is the internet the enemy of, or the great liberator of trivia? Because there is this idea that, you know, it's open source and everyone can find everything. I'm reassured that this makes a lovely volume, a book in print, and it has a charm of its own because it's not on a screen. Do you have a love-hate relationship with the old World Wide Web?
Yes, I do. I mean, an awful lot of what I do is online. I write for a lot of websites. I've run my own blog and my own website and the Twitter account and everything alongside all of this. So I love that side of things. I love the social media side of things. It's immensely frustrating how much sort of misinformation there is out there. It's very frustrating that you can, especially coming from a language point of view, an etymological point of view, I'll look up a word online and read a story that's been sent around everywhere and it just won't be true. And I know it isn't true, but it seems to be kind of widely disseminated. So, yeah, it can be frustrating, but I mean, half my career is on there, so I can't be too angry with it, I don't think.
Let's talk about a couple more of the examples. I've mentioned a couple already, and at the risk of making you choose your favourites, what are a couple of the standouts? Because there's some absolutely brilliant ones. There's some that are kind of intuitive and others that are completely surprising and baffling. What are some that stand out for you?
The one that actually I keep coming back to is the one that gave me the idea to put this book together, which is a brilliant word, Stellenbosch, which is the name of a town in South Africa. I wrote this up as a blog post a couple of years ago, and this kind of gave me the idea to collect some of these sort of place name words together. To Stellenbosch someone in old army slang is to kind of demote them, but not demote them. It's almost sort of you move them to a position that's still really important, so they can't complain that they've been demoted, but it is, to everyone else looking at them, a sign that they've been sort of moved backwards or have been moved down. And this comes from the idea that in Stellenbosch, in South Africa, during the Boer War, there was what was called a remount camp, which was a camp for military horses. And any officer whose front line running of battles or of running of the war hadn't paid off, if their tactics in warfare hadn't worked, they would be put in charge of this Stellenbosch camp. So they couldn't complain because war horses were immensely important. So they couldn't complain that they've been moved backwards, but it wasn't frontline duty. So to be Stellenboshed is to kind of be kind of strategically sidelined. It's put out of harm's way. And I love the fact that there's even a word for that. I love the fact that someone's seen this gap in the language and that a word has been provided for it. And it's also, it's just a bonus that it's got this brilliant story hidden behind it. So that is definitely one of my favourites.
That's right up there. And I'm determined to put that into effect. I may have to Stellenbosch a few colleagues just in order to get some wider exposure to it, Paul. Well, speaking of Stellenbosch, it's also a beautiful wine country, I know for a fact, of course, around there in South Africa. And I rather enjoyed daiquiri, Cuba. Tell us about the daiquiri cocktail then.
Yeah, no one's entirely sure almost where it comes from. Daiquiri is the name of a tiny port on, I think it's on the south coast of Cuba or something like that. And there's all kinds of stories about where this cocktail comes from, who made it, what it originally contained. There are lots of stories that it was made by local mining engineers who had wanted to make their own drink. It was a bar that had run out of gin, and so they switched to rum and nobody noticed. There's all kinds of different stories as to why it's named after this tiny little port. But yeah, it's this little Cuban destination has suddenly become very well known for giving us this cocktail.
And if we just sweep across into Latin America, there's another one that which I found particularly interesting, because you sort of pose a kind of chicken and egg question in the book, and that's Brazil, as in, you know, where the nuts come from. But do they? Is this a chicken and egg? What's the kind of the mystery? Unpick it for us, Paul.
There are a couple of these sort of chicken and egg ideas in the book. Turkey, which I've already mentioned, is another one of them. But Brazilnut is probably the toughest one because we have Brazilnuts, we have the country Brazil, we have a mythical island that was known as Brazil, which was on kind of medieval maps just to the west of Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, which of course it doesn't exist, but is it a reference to South America? We don't really know. And there's the Brazilnut tree. And so you're left with these kind of four avenues to look down, and you look back and back and back through all kinds of evidence to find out which one came first. It seems that what happens is the island that we thought lay off the Republic of Ireland is the very first mention of Brazil. And when things began to be imported to Europe from these sort of far-flung colonies on the other side of the world that were only just being discovered, that we presumed they came from Brazil. Whether it was the nuts or whether it was the timber that came first, we don't know. So we kind of have to draw a bit of a question mark there. But yes, it's one of these ones where it's kind of easier on paper than it is to explain, certainly.
Just a final thought then, Paul. I guess one thing that it must be quite fun to do is to sort of myth bust and to sort of explode these preconceptions. You've talked a bit about all that already. You can't go so far as to tell me that the Great Dane isn't Danish, though, can you?
Unfortunately, it isn't. It comes from Germany, and it's one of these things that fell foul of kind of all the anti-German sentiment around the First and Second World Wars. So whereas we had sort of German measles became Liberty measles and sauerkraut became Liberty cabbage and things, the Great Dane, which was originally a German dog, morphed to slightly north of the border and it ended up in Denmark.
Paul Anthony Jones there speaking to Tom Edwards, and Paul's book Around the World in 80 Words is out now from Elliot and Thompson. Tom, that's it for edition 486 of the Monocle Weekly. I had a nice time in the studio today with you and assorted guests.
It was a great show, and it definitely had its Midori haunted house feel about it.
Very much so.
Ahead of Halloween.
Yeah, it's good. Subhadra was good, wasn't she?
Really interesting stuff. Light touch and some dark subject matter. Very, very, very interesting.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Thanks to all our guests and, of course, our pals behind the glass. Today's show is produced by Tom Hall and researched by Martha Libri. Our studio managers were Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.